So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
I've been told to project my voice. Speaking from my diaphragm.
Project. I have a project to complete proficiently. Welcome to Review Away. I am John Pollock, joined by Mr. WrestleMania, Wei Ting.
Okay, why?
You're wearing your WrestleMania hoodie.
Oh, of course. Clothing reference.
I'm wearing my G1 hoodie.
No, you're not.
I'm Mr. August, Masahiro Chono.
You're wearing plaid.
That's true, I am.
A brand new shirt.
As always.
I like this shirt. Do you like it?
It's nice. Actually, yeah. It's very nice.
It's nice, nicely fitted. Did you pick it, or did your wife?
She bought it for me, yes.
Yes, I could tell.
Oh, wow. What's that supposed to mean?
So your wife has great taste?
Man.
That's what it means.
I like talking about fashion with you.
Do you really?
I feel me and WH could start a wrestling fashion podcast. He's the man when it comes to fashion sense in pro wrestling, which is a subgenre unto its own. You got to go really deep on the Reddit threads for that one.
I would love a fashion blog dedicated solely to professional wrestlers.
That is WH's calling.
Oh, yeah.
Like, everyone finds their niche. And WH, I mean, there's no one better.
Yeah.
Breaking down, like, gear and hair, schemes.
He'd be the Joan Rivers of pro wrestling fashion.
Oh, could you imagine that if they incorporated that into the Hall of Fame now that they do the red carpet and we could get, like, who are you wearing? I'm wearing Tap Out.
I definitely think there's a market. There's a niche for that. There's, like, a niche for anything. So, WH, please. WH pro wrestling fashion blog.
Yeah, there's got to be some great title with a name like WH Park that you can make into some fashion.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking of it. My brain's not fully working at this hour. This is very early for us.
It's always early for
me. It's 1 in the morning.
Yeah, anything before 4 p.m. is early for me.
Yeah, it's just a complete chaotic time period in life. Mm-hmm. You're getting set for a big trip next week.
Be in Saskatchewan.
Saskatchewan?
Yep.
Do you still hear Goldust say Saskatchewan in your head? No. Every time I hear the word Saskatchewan, I think of Goldust in Wrestling with Shadows saying Saskatchewan.
Oh, no, I never think of that.
Are you going to meet our pal Rob? Rob from Saskatoon?
I don't know if he'll be there. If I see him at the UFC event,
This is an MMA event. It's Rob.
Does he cover MMA?
He doesn't cover it, but I mean, the man is, I mean, you used to run attendance? The Fight Finder on Sherdog.
True.
I hope he's going to be able to find the fight.
Yes.
On Sunday night.
If I see him, if you're attending, Rob, please say hi. We'll chat.
Well, he should, the onus is on him to find you. He's got to track you down. It's a specialty. You know what has been tremendous of late it's a theme that I want to encourage have been a number of listeners, great people, sending us Tim Hortons e-cards.
Mm-hmm.
I've been drinking coffee for free for a month now, and it's been fantastic.
It's not necessarily something I wouldn't necessarily request it.
Demand it.
I think
it's a must.
It's incredibly
you
kind.
You want this show to continue.
It's incredibly nice that anybody you know, is willing to send any like us free stuff. It's great. Thank you. But it's not definitely nothing I expect.
Three people have sent us cards over the past month. We have a lot more than three listeners, so I don't want to say things. The math doesn't add up.
Oh, boy.
I don't ever want to pay for a coffee again.
You're just a dick. You're just taking advantage of your celebrity.
You know what's the most awkward part of gift cards is when I went to go get – I got a bagel and a coffee before this, and it came out to like $3.10, and I had $2.96 left.
On the card?
So your natural inclination is just to – I'll just pay for it or something like that. But I've read about how some of these companies make so much money every year off of just little fees left on your card that you don't use.
Definitely.
So I scanned it and I said, I'll pay the difference.
I do that all the time. You know, the other thing is if you have the app.
That's what I use.
You can merge balances on cards.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, you got to show me how to do that. I had three multiple cards I'm working.
They don't make it that easy either. So I'm sure they bank on, you know, all these people like Best Buy. I'm sure
it's crazy. They bank on the amount of gift cards I've gotten in my lifetime that I've never used, it's just insane.
Yeah.
Insane. I would much rather just get money from people rather than gift cards.
Yeah, I do too. I would too. But I think anybody would. It's just not as personal of a gift, you know?
I mean, the idea of getting a Best Buy gift card, for instance, and you go and, I don't know, you get a $50 card, you go get a DVD. The odds of me going back to Best Buy in any timely fashion and remembering that I have $15 left on this card, not happening at all.
Well, I think what usually happens is, you know, somebody like me, for instance, I'm kind of cheap, so like I would want to use up everything. But what ends up happening is I end up spending more. I end up spending at least, you know.
You're going to get three items. More. They're not going to equal $50. They're going to be $64.
Yes.
And now I've spent 14 of my own damn money.
Yeah. So it's brilliant.
They're just what a scam. Whoever came up with this. I wonder if they knew the residual effects of these. It's like we're basically taking people's money and not giving them that value back in most cases.
Sure.
For every person like you that's going to use every cent on that, there are way more that are going to overspend or just forget about them.
You know what would be a better idea is if you wanted to give somebody a gift card, why don't you take an envelope, write Best Buy on it, and stuff that envelope with the money that you're going to use to buy a gift card.
So much easier. You don't have to go out and buy the card. Just give them cash.
Yeah.
Liquid cash.
So you'll be doing that for my birthday, I take it.
Sure.
Just cash.
Of course.
Great. Where's my gift this year, actually?
I haven't got a gift from you ever.
That's not true.
You've gotten me gifts when you've...
I got you some DVDs. 1 year.
What DVDs?
Some Pacific Mall. Some pirate.
Oh, yeah. Dude, that was when we were in university. Yeah. I remember this.
You got like 10 years.
They were all like these shitty printed off titles on the front.
I got clearly.
They were awesome.
$3 for $5.
That's amazing. Is Pacific Mall still the place to be?
No, they don't. They don't really.
They were raided like a few years ago.
Many years
ago,
yeah. Now it's the place to be if you're looking for fake iPhone cases.
Oh.
Yeah.
Fake iPhone cases.
Oh, yeah.
Can't go the legit route.
No.
Wow.
I got you one from there, too.
A phone case?
Yeah.
Huh.
Way back.
Was that the one with the money on it?
No.
No?
No, okay. It had some type of design on the back, and then it started to peel off.
Oh, I do remember that. I asked you to buy me that.
Pretty low quality case.
Yes. I used that for quite a while, though.
Yeah.
That was great. I can't remember the last time I got you a gift.
Oh.
See, sometimes we've gone to on like trips, and we'll bring some stuff back for Jay or Dan. But I'm always with you, so I'm not gonna buy you a thing when you and I go on.
You won't be getting anything from Saskatoon, that's for sure.
Wow, that's just amazing.
Yeah.
Well, you know what we're gonna do next year? I'm gonna take you when we're in Dallas. I'm gonna take you to the South Fork Ranch.
Yeah. Okay.
And we're gonna go. And you're going to try some of the, hands down, the worst coffee I've ever had in my life
that they sold
at the gift shop. And then we're going to go on the tour of the grounds. We're going to see the pool where Kristen plunged to her death. We're going to see the inside where the fire took place.
Yeah.
Actually, the inside was all shot on a studio lot, and it was just the exteriors that were actually shot in Dallas at the South Fork Ranch, which actually, South Fork's actually not even located in Dallas. It's outside of Dallas.
Great. Thank you.
I now know what I want to review in a few weeks.
Okay.
I think 1 week we've got to just sit down, and you and I, we're going to watch a few episodes of Dallas. I think that'd be a hell of a lot of fun.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see about that.
I think you'd love this show. If you give it a chance, it's a lot like a lawnmower. You've got to pull at the gas, and it's going to take a few swings before you finally get it going, and then you're going to fall in love with it. You know when you pull the thing on the lawnmower to get it going, the motor going?
Who the fuck has ever been in love with a lawnmower?
You don't like mowing lawns? I thought it was very relaxing when I was young. That was a chore I enjoyed
what
doing.
What a weird analogy.
You don't like to... Didn't you have a lawnmower when you were younger?
Yeah.
Did you have the kind you would ride?
No.
My grandparents had one of those, like the thing you would sit and ride.
Wow. Okay, so Dallas is just like that.
Exactly. It's the lawnmower of television shows.
All right. You hooked me. I'm set. I'm going to get set to rev this thing. Dallas.
Are you ready to chat about the G1?
These chants are like getting weirder and weirder. These bits of banter.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No. Not really.
Did you watch Jon Stewart's final show last week?
I did, actually.
Oh, what did you think?
We could chat about
I forgot
that.
To ask you this on Monday.
I just watched it this weekend. Oh, man, I thought it was really good. Really good.
I can't believe they got... I imagine it was every single correspondent. I didn't notice any omissions.
I don't know. I don't really watch the show.
I already feel the fact-checking thread. Actually, there was a correspondent in 2006 that was unaccounted for.
They seem to get almost everybody, and, you know...
Even Wyatt Cenac was there.
I don't know who that is, but who's
he
that?
Was, he was who's the guy that, that, that guy? Was... he was the black correspondent who was... had just done Mark Maron's podcast a week ago, and it kind of created this stir that... Jon Stewart had told this joke that Wyatt Cenac later talked to Stewart about, thinking it was kind of racist. And Stewart, like, blew him off and thought he was being absolutely ridiculous.
So they had a bit of beef.
They had a bit of a beef. So
was it addressed on the show?
No, but it was... Wyatt Cenac was positioned like he was outside.
Yeah.
And they had the awkward exchange of just, how's it going? It's good. You good?
Got it.
Yeah.
Right, that one.
And he's like, my social media is blowing up right now.
Yeah, I knew there was some context.
Because he was the one no one expected that would be on there. And
of course.
To their credit, they got him.
Yeah. It was incredible to me that they had so many people there and so many, you know, A-listers in Colbert, somebody like Steve Carell. And I guess Colbert had a larger role. But, you know, somebody like Steve Carell or Ed Helms, they were just flown in to do one line. And then they were, you know, kind of cut the camera cut away to the next person.
Like, it's amazing just to see them all. The level of talent that went through that place.
Absolutely.
And got their start on that show. Like, look at the spinoffs that show has created.
Mm-hmm.
Like, John Oliver in there as well they got.
Yep.
Even Rob Corddry.
Yeah.
Who's on Ballers now with The Rock.
The whole thing, I thought, was done incredibly well. But I was especially impressed by the you know, quote-unquote, one-take montage of basically a credit roll of all the people that work behind the scenes. I mean, just as somebody who works in television production, I think a lot of the people behind the scenes never really get their credit. And I just compare it to, you know, some other final episodes of talk shows that I've seen in the past, and often it's very boring how, like, you might get a little slideshow, like Letterman might have done, like, a little slideshow at the end of his thing. But this, they did it in just a way more creative and way more entertaining of a way to, you know, give shout outs to all the people that work back there, but, you know, while entertaining you and not making it boring at the same time. I thought it was really well done.
They did have a brief cameo with the new host, Trevor Noah.
Mm-hmm.
How do you... I think this transition is going to be so hard for this guy. Because
it's always weird.
A, he's generally unknown to a lot of people. B, he's coming into a program that it's like the Daily Show wasn't a political show when Jon Stewart took it over. He created this entire Daily Show franchise, essentially. No one recalls the Craig Kilborn version. I mean, it was pretty much off the beaten path. But now, if you go political, I think it's just going to be really, really difficult. And that's what people are expecting and might not be to the strength of a Trevor Noah to go to. I think this is going to be a really, really tough transition.
Are they keeping the same staff, the writing team?
I don't know. I have no clue. I don't know if he's bringing in his own people or they're I would imagine you saw the size of that staff. I couldn't imagine too much of an overhaul when you have that whole show is in place, essentially.
I think anytime you have something that's incredibly successful, that's about to end, you know, you can either choose to redo it or keep it going, or you can just go a completely different route. And you know, maybe that's what they're doing with this.
See, I find as well, this is my own personal preference, is that when I tune into people that are covering politics, whether it's in comedy or even in a serious fashion, I think you're going to take a older person. Not that Jon Stewart was ancient, but I mean, like Trevor Noah is my age.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I feel that he's going to have a really tough time trying to grab that same audience that Jon Stewart acquired. At the same time, while Stephen Colbert is going to be starting on CBS very soon, mm-hmm. and that's another one that is the Daily Show audience going to go over there? Are they just going to tune out completely?
I don't know.
Are you going to continue watching The Daily Show?
I never really watched it.
Oh, well, then you're lost.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Trevor Noah will bring you in. Maybe he'll be a...
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going with a fresh slate on the guy because I've seen very little of his work.
I think good TV will always, you know, get people's attention. So it doesn't necessarily have to stick to the same formula. It probably has to find its own voice.
It's going to have to, but I just think it's going to be a long process of finding that. Like John Oliver, he started on HBO, mm-hmm. and man, that guy had a brand new show immediately. I think he's fantastic. He's incredible.
That's like, I mean, I've seen that show, and it is very good. But
once a week,
it's very much the same formula, though, as The Daily Show.
It is, but I feel they go so much more in depth. They pick one big story.
Which they joked about on during his cameo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What the fuck is a commercial break?
Yeah.
He's been really fantastic, I think, on that show. Mm-hmm. Colbert, I think the best thing that guy is going for him is that you're going into an election year, which I think he has a huge advantage over Fallon and Kimmel, which are not going to be able to... I think Colbert has better resources to cover the entire election next year, as opposed to Fallon and Kimmel, who have the built-in audiences at
that
time.
Is he still going
to
go by Colbert?
I assume so. I mean, that's how he's been announced, but he's got to drop the character.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to watch, I guess.
Yeah.
Late night TV. It's going to be a fun fall.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe literally for some.
Yeah.
So that's all.
Yep. Cool.
Do you think that Masahiro Chono could have done well in a late night hosting position back in the mid-90s? Mr. August.
I don't know. Yes. Yes, he could have.
I lied. I gave you the wrong 5 years to review, so we're going to actually review 10 different finals today.
Oh, wow.
No,
really?
I'm kidding. We're going to go through 5 various finals of the G1 spanning the entire history of the G1, going back to the very first tournament in August of 1991.
Some of these matches, I feel it's been a month since I've seen.
Yes, we were going to do this review last week before the Piper show, and where you were getting on this right away. I can always tell when you're really engaged in a review because you start watching it right away instead of waiting to the last minute.
I was actually looking forward. The best reviews, I think, are the ones that I actually have an interest in knowing more about, like topics that I probably didn't know that much about, but I was curious.
Are you saying you have not been interested in a fall brawl show of the past?
I'm not. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Well, I too was looking forward to going back and watching this. You mentioned how long ago it was you watched this Muto Chono. This was one of my review away trip-ups because I watched this match about a month ago, and then a few weeks later we decided we were going to review these shows. I was like, well, we have to review the first year, and I'm going to have to go back and review it because I did not take notes the first time around.
Mm.
It was one time I actually decided just to watch wrestling for enjoyment,
you'll never
which
make-
literally like never happens for me anymore.
You'll never
life.
Make that mistake again. You must take notes.
I think, seriously, any time now, if I go back and watch something that I think there's a sliver of a chance we might review one day, I'm taking notes and just banking them on my computer.
That includes Dallas and The Daily Show?
Everything. Yes. Everything I am going to take notes for in my life. Mm-hmm. Total Divas.
Coffee runs at Tim Hortons. Absolutely.
I'm always thinking and writing.
Good.
So the first year, Keiji Muto and Masahiro Chono. This was a very, very important tournament because what they had done was they had booked four straight nights of shows. They were going to be in Nagoya on night one, and then three consecutive nights at Sumo Hall, much like the WWE running the Barclays Center for NXT, SummerSlam, and Raw. Three consecutive nights, a very ambitious undertaking. Actually, quite a lot of parallels between those two. I mean, that's a big undertaking. And going into this, Riki Choshu was the booker of New Japan Pro Wrestling at the time, and this was in the post-Antonio Inoki era, and they really did not have their next set star. They did not have Roman Reigns in the on-deck circle. They did not have their number one guy. So this tournament was going to put three guys in motion to be kind of your standard bearers for the 90s. We had Shinya Hashimoto, who was already at a certain level, and this tournament would emphasize him, but as well bringing up Masahiro Chono and Keiji Muto alongside Hashimoto, and this was essentially the trace point to the Three Musketeers and being who they believed were going to be the three major figures of the 90s for the company.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to just ask you about the whole concept of the G1 in general. I know New Japan previously had tournaments, but why the rebranding of the G1 and what was different about it from previous tournaments?
Well, this was just going to be a heavyweight round-robin tournament. It was a concept to create a new star, and it was a big undertaking by putting them in Sumo Hall. So instantly you're telling people these are going to be big shows. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was unique combinations involving all of the people in the two blocks.
It was a combination of mid-card and upper, like, champions.
Yeah, exactly. It was all heavyweights, and you had some established talent, especially in the case of Riki Choshu. And then you had others where it was they were the level below. And I mean, the tournament had no identity in year one, yeah. But after the first one, you kind of established what this was going to be. It was a chance to create new stars, whether it was through upsets and the various stories you could tell throughout these four shows.
It was surprising to me to read some of the brackets in this tournament where you had Muto on his road to the finals beating the champion, the IWGP champion, Tatsumi Fujinami here. And, you know, I just don't necessarily see the King of the Ring, for instance. I definitely don't see the champion being involved in the King of the Ring, much less having a mid-carder beat the champion in the body of the tournament.
Yeah, and that's become something that, and we'll get into it later in future years, where you would put the IWGP heavyweight champion into the tournament. And on the surface, it's, well, what does this person have to gain by winning this? But what is gained from a booking philosophy is that they don't need to lose a ton of matches in the G1, but the key ones they do lose sets up title matches coming out of the tournament.
Right.
And that's something we've seen this year in the G1 with Okada, and we've seen in the past where even the finals have been the ability to set someone up. And now the G1, it's the winner gets that guaranteed title shot. But at this point, Fujinami losing, it was a huge win for Keiji Muto and propelling him into the finals with Chono and their final.
Also important to note is Riki Choshu, the booker, booked himself to go 0-3 in this tournament.
Unheard of in professional wrestling. Mm-hmm. A booker who lost every one of his matches. He was in the B block with Bam Bam Bigelow, Shinya Hashimoto, and Masahiro Chono. And yeah, Choshu lost to all three guys, and it was huge, especially for Chono. I think Chono got the most out of beating Riki Choshu. Mm. And Hashimoto, I think he was already at a certain level. I think people saw him as being one of the next stars. But again, it was a really profound statement that Riki Choshu was just going to come in here and he was going to let his opponents just clean the table with him, and he would have 0 points. And then on the A block, we had Muto, Fujinami, Scott Norton, and Big Van Vader, who, again, was a massively pushed foreigner for New Japan by this time in 1991. losing as well to Muto, which was a huge victory for him.
Mm.
So that sets up the first finals in August of 1991, Keiji Muto and Masahiro Chono. And Muto had beaten Vader to get to the finals. And Muto was 28 years old at this time. Mm. Looked like a completely different human being in 1991 than today, yeah. For instance.
Yeah. This was after his NWA run.
Yeah, after his 89 run in the NWA and had kind of just settled into the middle of the card in New Japan. Chono was 27. The two had had their debut match against each other in 1984, so you had that natural link. I love the way this started, where the crowd is insane here at Sumo Hall. They're very excited for this match. And it wasn't like we just went right to the collar and elbow tie-up or one attacked. They just had this long stare.
With great facials.
Holy Christ.
Especially.
It was a slow start, and then they went into this test of strength. But this stare, it set the tone for me for the entire match. I thought it was so cool.
Well, you have to, you know, think about the context that led up to this moment. It was, what, three nights of shows?
Yeah.
Leading up to this. And so by this point, you had plenty of buildup, and this crowd was obviously anticipating this match.
And you had all the momentum of these wins and two unlikely contenders to be vying for this championship. And that's a testament to getting that G1 concept across in this first incarnation of it, that this was something important they were fighting over. Had this just been a tournament of mid-carders and we're crowning the best of the mid-carders, I don't know if it would have had the same substance.
AKA the King of the Ring.
That's what the King of the Ring is, and it's not taken seriously, but this featured the champion, this featured a legend in Riki Choshu, and these guys got key victories, and it was a sign that, wow, this is important, what they're fighting for. Chono was working the left arm, and Muto's blocking, and finally Muto goes to the floor, returns, continues to go after the left arm of Chono. He went for a handspring and missed a back elbow into the corner. Crowd was super hot here at Sumo Hall. It was sold out for this final night. Muto ties up his legs and applies the Muto lock, working over the arm of Chono. Chono escapes, and the people just cheer here as he kicks Muto in the face with a pair of Yakuza kicks, sending Muto off the apron and into the barricade, and then Chono hits a suicide dive, which was the biggest spot thus far in the match. Chono comes off the top and crashes into Muto while he's standing, and then Chono hits these two pile drivers, goes for another on the floor, and takes a back body drop, and it's Muto who then returns the favor and drops Chono with a pile driver on the cement, right on the floor. And he sends Chono back into the ring, proceeds to hit a missile drop kick that Chono kicks out of, and the match really picks up at this point. Chono goes for the Gotch-style pile driver, then a dragon suplex, and then Chono is into the ropes. Muto misses with a top rope moonsault, allowing Chono to apply the STF, and Muto gets the rope break. There's an octopus stretch. Again, Muto breaks it up, and then Muto hits a missile drop kick. Both men are down. Chono applies the STF, immediately gets the rope break, and then Chono gets his knees up for another moonsault, lifts up Muto, power bombs him on his neck, and stacks him on top, and pins Muto. Went 30 minutes, and the crowd start throwing the pillows into the ring, which here at Sumo Hall, it's a very uncomfortable venue to sit in for these long shows, so they would give out pillows to sit on the chairs. And it was always for the sumo matches, and later it crossed over to pro wrestling, the major sign of respect to throw the pillows in the ring.
What?
Yes.
Really?
So maybe that fan who threw the briefcase and hit Roman Reigns in the back of the head on the weekend, maybe he was just trying to convey his respect and just did it in a bad way.
Yeah.
So wait, next time I throw a pillow at you, don't get all mad and kick me.
I should say thanks. I thought it was a very good match. Very technical, very athletic, very good psychology, very well paced and laid out. And it felt very special knowing considering the story here of two younger guys basically getting the spotlight to steal the show and being able to do so in tremendous fashion.
And this would kind of catapult Masahiro Chono. There was a great closing scene because you had Muto in the ring and Hashimoto joined them and doing the Antonio Inoki slogan at the end. And it was a defining moment for the next decade for the company, because here was this big show, a sold out crowd, a very important arena for them in Sumo Hall, and announcing these are our stars. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be one guy that replaces Antonio Inoki. It's going to be this collective. And
their booking throughout the 90s was always kind of the idea that anyone can beat anyone. There was a lot of parody on top, and it created a new generation for New Japan, and they would have enormous success throughout the 90s before things came crashing down.
Yeah. And I really do think, you know, the booker here, Riki Choshu, should be commended for you know, putting over these two guys with basically this whole tournament. It seemed to be designed to get these three people over. And I thought, at least from this perspective, it seemed like it worked really well.
And Chono, we mentioned earlier, I mean, he would be dubbed Mr. August because the G1 is the tournament that was synonymous with Masahiro Chono. He'd win it right. The next year, then he'd win it again in 94, and then after that he would follow it up with wins in 2002 and 2005. So the most wins of anyone in the G1 belonging to Chono.
Cool.
Who is only 20.
He's the Jordan of the G1.
He is. He is. He's the Jordan. And at this point in time, he would be the youngest to win the G1 for years and years until Okada finally won it. The next one we're going to cover is we fast forward 5 years to 1996, where a 12-year-old Wei Ting called into Starphone to get the results of Riki Choshu and Masahiro Chono. Did you ever call into Starphone?
Course I did. We've had this conversation. Jolt and Joe. And the Law used to have a line.
The Law had a line on Starphone. Prior to Jolt and Joe, it was Norm DaCosta.
Yes.
My favorite.
Who didn't know anything about
pro wrestling. No, knew nothing. He was a soccer reporter who, I guess, just...
He's just reading off the results on somewhere.
He would always... Like, his... There are people that can mispronounce names, and it's like you cringe, and there's others where it's just... It's so perfect.
Yeah.
And he was one of them. And when I was like 8, 9 years old... Reading his columns in the Toronto Star, like where he was like, he wrote about it, like he wasn't out and out, like this stuff is real. Like there was a little, if you knew what you were watching, he wasn't going to insult your intelligence, but at no point did he kind of expose what wrestling was. And I loved just the idea of reading about pro wrestling in the sports section.
Oh, yeah.
Was just such a novelty to me.
Oh, it was before the internet, before any of this stuff came out. The Law wasn't even out yet.
Oh, yeah. This was like I remember it like 92 first reading about wrestling in the Toronto Star.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what their G1 coverage was like in 1996. I cannot recall. But this was a huge tournament. They announced prior to this that this was going to be Riki Choshu's final G1. And also, still the booker at this point for New Japan Pro Wrestling. And they were going to run shows from August 2nd to 6th at Sumo Hall, and they had over 55,000 people attend these shows
in total
for over $3 million that they generated.
Wow.
So Choshu made this big announcement going into the tournament as, you know, he's the aging legend that's going to try and win one final time. And they just maximized the drama out of this.
Oh, he seemed like a super sentimental babyface with this crowd.
And it was the complete opposite of the 1991 tournament because he swept things in the round robin. He had some phenomenal matches with Kensuke Sasaki was one of them that really stood out, as well as Shinya Hashimoto, and also had a win over Hiroyoshi Tenzan in that opening round robin tournament. And it set up the finals with Chono. And I have not watched all of the matches from the round robin, but the general consensus was, it was just like blow-away matches, in particular the Hashimoto and Sasaki matches.
Would you say the quality of a typical match during a G1 tournament is different from, you know, let's say a typical undercard match in any of the rest of the year in New Japan?
I've not watched by any means every G1, but it's like right always now. Regarded as like some of the best wrestling matches of the year. I mean, this is a major event on the calendar every year for New Japan, and the talent, I mean, it's a very high bar considering who's in there. I mean, there's been bad years, but the bar was really set with these phenomenal wrestling matches. So I think that they were above your rank and file, you know, average matches, I would say. Choshu was 44 years old at this particular time coming into this match with Chono. So you had the story here of the guy who had won three G1s at this point, going after his fourth here against Choshu. And early on, Choshu hits him with three consecutive Saito suplexes that got this massive response. This crowd was just in love with Riki Choshu.
From the beginning, this crowd was very hot.
Chono rolls to the floor, and gets knocked down with strikes in the corner when he returns. Chono attacks the left knee of Choshu, goes for the STF, and Choshu is constantly making it to the rope. A pair of Yakuza kicks. Choshu then stops Chono on top and hits a superplex, and Chono then wrenches the knee, going for the STF as the crowd is just exploding. And then Choshu battles to the ropes. Tatsumi Fujinami is on the floor, and he slaps Riki Choshu to get him going. Yeah. I mean, here is one of his career rivals that's just trying to will Choshu on.
Career rival, but somebody who was a contemporary of that previous generation, basically trying to get this guy to fight for their generation of wrestlers against these new guys.
And then Chono spits in the direction of Fujinami, just this prick who has no respect for these... the older generation.
It was really fun to be able to see Chono's evolution in this match compared to the previous one. Just in the span of 5 years, to see how much this guy had evolved into his own character. Like in that 91 match, he very much just seemed like a creative wrestler, you know, in look especially. Here, you know, he had grown that goatee.
Yeah, and, in the black leather.
Black leather. Just really seemed, it became more of a dick as well. So it was cool to see the comparison.
Chono hit a pile driver, follows with a second one, and Choshu instantly kicks out. There's a pair of mafia kicks, and then Choshu again kicks out at one. There's a running boot, and Choshu just bounces off the rope, hitting Chono with a lariat, hits a second one, and then applies the Sasori Gatami, the sharpshooter.
The Scorpion Deathlock.
The Scorpion Deathlock, and crowd goes insane. He lets it go. Choshu falls with another lariat and then reapplies the submission, and this time Chono is forced to submit, and this crowd goes ballistic.
Mm-hmm.
Only 13 minutes and 45 seconds. I thought it was the perfect length of time.
Oh, yeah.
And you gave the crowd the finish they wanted so badly with a believable challenger that it wasn't just a foregone conclusion that you were going to tell the heartwarming story of Choshu winning. There was totally this crowd that believed Chono was going to win yet again.
I expected that. You know, it almost seemed like a better retirement story for the guy to lose having tried so hard. But, you know, the crowd definitely loved this. And even without, you know, knowing the context or seeing the rest of the tournament, the reaction from this crowd alone just made it seem like a very memorable moment. And I'll have to say, not having seen much of Riki Choshu at all, this was some of the best babyface underdog selling that I've ever seen here. I mean, this crowd is just cheering for this old man to just reach deep down to keep on fighting, and he was able to exhibit that really, really well.
And here we are 19 years later, and Riki Choshu is still working at times.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, his retirement was it was his final G1. We'll give him that.
He'll stick to that.
Yeah. Next up was 2004.
Wait a second. What happened in between?
Went down. The promotion completely fell on its ass.
Just briefly,
Some of the major highlights, I mean, throughout this point in time, I mean, you had Inoki's retirement in April of 1998, and then into the 2000s, that was when you shifted a lot, and it was, you know, with the rise of Pride, which you cannot tell the history of New Japan over the last 15 years without talking about Pride and how Inoki was involved with Pride, and that crossed over to New Japan with back and forth where you would send your wrestlers to do shoot matches and conversely bring shooters over, whether it was from K1 or Pride or any fighters to work pro wrestling matches, and it became a massive detriment to the company.
So these were essentially sort of the dark ages of New Japan?
Yeah, I mean, by 2004, I mean, the company had really, I would say they started to take a big dive in 2002. You had seen Muto leave the company and go over to All Japan at that point, along with Koji Kanemoto and Satoshi Kojima leaving. And then, conversely, into the latter parts of the 2000s, I mean, you had some great talent. I mean, Yuji Nagata, I mean, he was one of my favorite guys in that early 2001 title run. But again, he was a guy that was thrown in there against Mirko Krokop, against Fedor, which were just, I mean, even today, that sounds fucking crazy.
Oh, dude, like, to go up against Fedor and Krokop in their primes, I don't expect the biggest heavyweights in the UFC, much less a pro wrestler who had done no MMA prior to that point. That's ridiculous.
I think it took a number on the pro wrestling audience to see their guys fail in those kind of situations. Yeah. I think that really hurt Nagata in terms of becoming that next level star. I mean, I would compare it to the same time period of 2001 and had the WWE sent Kurt Angle to go to a UFC fight and he just got waxed.
Yeah.
This guy that you do want to believe, who does have credentials, and Kurt Angle higher credentials than Yuji Nagata, but seeing him fail in that situation and then come back to WWE and be your top guy, there was a disconnect there because so much of it was built in this reality that your top stars in New Japan, we know it's not real, but we know these guys are legitimate. So that really hurt them at times. They would, even by 2004, they would still have many more rough years after this. It wasn't until, you know, they had an uptick in business later in the decade, but it really wasn't until 2011, 2012 that things took a big shift.
Right.
They had a rough time in the 2000s. And 2004, I picked this because this was the first time that we saw Hiroshi Tanahashi go into the G1, and being in the finals in 2004 with Hiroyoshi Tenzan, who, if you only have been following New Japan the last few years, you know he's a very well-respected figure. But, I mean, it's painful watching this guy at this point in the G1. He's 44 and just a shell of what he once was, just physically. So watching this in 2004, this was when he was much closer to his prime, only 33 at this point.
He's the defending G1 champion.
Yeah, he had won it in 2003, defeating Jun Akiyama, which was a phenomenal final as well.
Tanahashi, I was doing a bit of research on him. He was just making his comeback from being stabbed by an ex.
Yes, yeah, and they brought this up before. Yeah, he was stabbed by
some reporter who he used to date.
Yeah, an ex-girlfriend, and it ended up being a big part of his story. So this was kind of part of his whole comeback at this point in 2004. So a full 11 years ago. So, I mean, this guy is, you know, kind of now getting into more of the still a very tremendous talent. I think he still has a number of years left. But 2004, he was still much more of a question mark in terms of how big of a star would he get. He was lacking certain things. But they did see him as one of those potential breakout stars in 2004. And going to the finals was certainly a sign of that. Also, what about a sponsorship here? General Motors.
Wow.
I wonder if they could have called this the GM tournament for this year alone. What a tie-in. Lots of blonde dye between these two. Hair dye?
Yeah.
Those were some of the notables.
I remember that. I actually remember that being a big thing, you know, just with Asian people in general. Like, I mean, it still kind of is, but I remember specifically when I was like 13, you know, like all of a sudden all the kids in my school, which is a large Asian population, everybody just started dyeing their hair. And I have no doubt.
Did you go through
that?
They
all watched the G1. I dyed my hair once.
Blonde?
No. No, more like an orange, and I never did it again. I thought it was stupid,
and that was it.
Yeah.
Well, I was mistaken. This was Tanahashi's second G1. He was in the 2003
first time in
version.
The finals, though.
Yeah, first time going to the finals, and the match starts off with Tanahashi just kept going back to this headlock, and they traded overhand chops. Tenzan, of course, with the Mongolian chops. Clothesline Tanahashi to the floor, and then Tenzan teases a dive and gets the audience all excited, but then he doesn't go for it. Tenzan repeated these headbutts to the skull in the corner, and this was notable to watch because they will do these now, especially Ishii and Goto. And the crowd, like, they do react to these headbutts, like, I will say that today, even though they're so sickening to watch. Here in 2004, like, I don't think the audience really cared that much, and they were just as damaging as they are today, but without the reaction here. Like, this was just like a setup spot.
They at least have, like, his hand covering, so, like, you're essentially just headbutting your own hand. Was it like that, or was it simply skull on skull?
Dude, Ishii and Goto, like they go in like two rams, just cracking each other forehead on forehead. There is no hand at all. Why you would do that, I have no idea. It's the stupidest spot in professional wrestling. So Tenzo,
would you rather be headbutted by a guy, or would you rather be slapped multiple times really hard?
Slapped, 100%.
Some of these slaps in the match that we're about to discuss next, I don't know if I necessarily take over a
head-on-head collision.
Well, it depends how many of the headbutts.
I don't want to take one headbutt. What a stupid idea. I'm going to take my head, and I'm going to hit you with it. And both of us are going to be in pain.
I would say the person doing the headbutting. I mean, I don't really know how the physics work of a headbutt. But if I were to take my car...
Think of two eggs. What do you think the physics of that are?
Right. Sure.
A slap stings, but a slap won't kill you.
Sure. Maybe one person's head is harder.
All right. Well, maybe that's the science behind it.
Yeah.
We'll have to wait a few decades, and we'll see if that theory proves true. Mm-hmm. So Tenzon, after the headbutts, Tanahashi hits a reverse cross off the turnbuckle. There's a superplex to Tenzon, who gets right up and hits a lariat. Then there was a diving headbutt off the top by Tenzon. Tanahashi hit a Toyota roll for a two count, and then followed with a suicide dive. He gets back into the ring, hits a missile drop kick, two rolling Germans bridging on the last one. And Tanahashi, I mean, he does it less and less now, but the Dragon Sleeper was a huge part of his repertoire at this point, and the people were going nuts here as he applied it. He then lets go, goes for the cover, and gets a two count. Tenzon with a spinning heel kick, getting his feet off the mat, which is somewhat novel by today's standards, and then hit the Tenzon Tombstone Driver, applies the Anaconda Vice, and Tanahashi turns it into a cradle for a two count. Tenzon missed a moonsault from the top. There was a Shining Wizard by Tanahashi, followed by a Dragon Suplex. Crowd was peaking at this point. There were a series of near falls by Tanahashi as they could sense he was going to get the biggest win of his career. And then the Dragon Sleeper is reapplied. Tenzon struggles to get up, turns into an inverted DDT, and he goes back to the Dragon Sleeper. Tenzon breaks free, headbutts to the midsection, and then another Tenzon Tombstone Driver. Tanahashi kicks out of that. He then takes a top rope moonsault from Tenzon for what I thought was an awesome near fall. Everyone bought this. Mm-hmm. And then applies the Anaconda Vice. Tanahashi's up. He gets slammed down and finally taps out at 21 minutes and 11 seconds. And Tenzon wins for the second consecutive year.
That final Anaconda Vice sequence was great. Really well done. Like, he just had it strapped on, and they were almost working like a bit of a test of strength into it, where Tanahashi would try to bridge out repeatedly, and Tenzon would just repeatedly drive him back down. And it lasted for like a good 30, 40 seconds, and it was really well done. Really good. The whole finish of this match, I thought, was very well done. The whole match itself was really good. It's wonderful that these guys have so many ways to finish a match, and it just kind of, you know, helped to make every near fall seem that much more believable. And I think the other thing I noted here was we didn't get to see much of the video because, like, on New Japan World, they just pretty much cut it after the pinfall pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But immediately after the pinfall, you see this look of shock on Tenzon's face that he had just won. And it's a reaction that we often see in real sports, perhaps. Like in the UFC, for instance, like a guy will get a knockout, and he'll just have this like incredible look of shock on his face that he can't believe he won. But I think it's very difficult to pull off in pro wrestling, because you know the outcome. It's hard to feign, you know, shock. But I thought Tenzon does it really well here.
Yeah, it was a great finish, a really great match. And this, even though Tanahashi lost, I think a lot of people looked at him. He was clearly going to be one of the focal points. You know, at 27 years of age, he was looked upon as, you know, that star for the future. And he would go on. He would win his first title in 2007. 2007, I believe that was when he won his first title. And that's the year we go to next with Tanahashi and Yuji Nagata. That's right, because Tanahashi won his first title, and then Nagata ended up beating him for it, and that would set up this rematch.
So Nagata here was champion.
Nagata was champion at this point in 2007, years removed from his MMA battles. Going back to the well. And it was unfortunate because, I mean, he was tremendous, and this guy's been tremendous for decades. You know, he's still, I think, a very, very good worker. And he's 47 now. And slowing down at this point in 2015. But, I mean, this was just the guy that, no matter what, New Japan could always rely on this guy. If it was just a transitional champion, whether it was a guy that we needed to challenge for the main event at a big show on a moment's notice, he was always that utility guy you could go to.
See, I'm sure, you know... If you when you Google Nujin Gata MMA like and see that basically the 1 minute KOs from both Fedor and Crow Cop, it probably doesn't help. But at the same time, I wonder if it actually does help his shoot fight character to an audience. You know, you can be a guy who has claimed to be a shooter, but to actually have somebody who has actually been in a fight and been in the ring with a Crow Cop and a Fedor.
On Sunday, I went to go watch this and clicked on the video. And on New Japan World, I see 43 minutes. I was like, oh, God.
Yeah.
And I texted Wei. I said, I'm sorry. I didn't realize how long Tanahashi Nagata was until clicking on it just now. And Wei responds, how long is it? And I said, 40 minutes. Damn it, John. And I felt bad. And I said, we can skip it if you want. Gonna have to cancel dinner with my parents. It's their birthday. No big deal. Not one of their birthdays. Both of their birthdays on the very same day that I'm having this conversation.
They actually have similar birthdays.
Really?
Yeah.
And I instantly realized what a jerk this guy was being.
I feel bad that you even feel the need to apologize to me now.
Listen, I clicked on this. I was like, was this match really that long? And we ended up getting quite the surprise.
Yeah, we did. But even if it were to be 40 minutes, I wouldn't care. Like, as long as it's good wrestling. If it's wrestling I'm actually interested in watching, I really don't mind. Even if it's like shit, whatever. It's fun.
Well, this match was about half that length. They included the entire post-match celebration and kind of the anointing of Hiroshi Tanahashi, which is what this was. I mean, yes, he had won the IWGP title, but this was a very significant win. This was the only time Tanahashi has won the G1.
Would you say one, you know, if you had to compare an IWGP title win or winning a G1, what would you say is a bigger accomplishment?
I mean, the title is the title. But I think the G1, it's just because of the historical nature of it. It's most years it's been designed to create that next star. And it's kind of that seal of approval that the guy is going to be at this certain level. We have a lot of big plans for him. And I think that at this point, yes, he had won the title. It hadn't been the longest reign in the world. And the fact that here he is not only winning the G1, but beating the guy who beat him for the title, that sets up a future title match with Nagata, which they would have later on. So, I mean, it was symbolic in that sense. And I think by 2007, there were a lot less questions about Tanahashi than there were in 2004. By this point, the guy's 30 years old, going into the prime of his career, and it was the next number of years that he became a main eventer and solidified his spot there. So, Tanahashi and Nagata coming into this as the IWGP champion and would set up a match coming out of this for later that year in October. We had Masahiro Chono on commentary as well at the start. They showed him. And then Nagata starts working the left arm of Tanahashi. Lots of fire and speed from Tanahashi. They're trading forearms. Nagata and the kicks to the chest that are just unbelievably brutal. I would think for a second over a headbutt versus one of these kicks to the chest.
You must have watched that Crow Cop footage over and over again.
Holy Christ. Tanahashi goes to the floor. He hit a spinning neck breaker to Nagata and then a dragon screw through the rope. So Nagata starts selling his right knee and Tanahashi comes off the second rope with a high cross body to the floor. Nagata then gets onto the apron. Tanahashi pulls him over the top and in, applying a rear choke and then into the dragon sleeper, follows with a missile drop kick to Nagata from the top, and then a big overhead suplex that Nagata responds with. Nagata lands his jumping knee in the corner, suplexes Tanahashi off the turnbuckle, attacks him with more kicks, a brainbuster, applies the Nagata Lock 3. Tanahashi gets to the ropes. Then they had just the most violent exchange of slaps you are ever going to see.
Yeah.
I mean, there is slapping the taste out of someone, and then there is this. Like, just full-on blows.
Like, these were pretty much, you know, open-fisted, open-palm
punches.
Like, if they had missed and hit the guy in the side of the ear, their eardrum would have been shattered, I feel.
Yeah. They look brutal. This was a very violent match.
Did you catch where Tanahashi... I mean, Tanahashi had his right elbow taped up,
yeah,
and then started bleeding.
I imagine probably just a pre-existing, you know...
cut. Must have been some cut or something like that, yeah, but just nasty when you're seeing that amount of blood coming mm-hmm. from, like, the elbow that's all taped up. Tanahashi then caught Nagata with the sling blade, hit the high fly flow for a near fall. Nagata hit an Olympic slam for a two count, was delivering knees to the chest, and then Tanahashi catches a kick, dragon screws him five times in a row to the injured knee, then hits a dragon suplex into a roll up for a two count, goes to the top and hits the high fly flow, which was a relatively new finish for Tanahashi at this point in 2007 and really established the move here, pinning Nagata in 19 minutes and 2 seconds and not 40.
Not 40.
This finish came out of nowhere.
I was surprised. I was so, totally surprised. I didn't buy any of the near falls. I saw 40 minutes on the timeline and ended in 21. So, an incredibly stiff match. Definitely the most violent of all the ones that we've seen here. And, you know, my point earlier about whether or not, yes, you know, you've seen Yuji Nagata get KO'd by two legit MMA fighters. But, you know, I went into this thinking, okay, sure, this guy did get knocked out by those two, but he also had the balls to get in the ring in a legit fight with both Miracle Crow Cop and Fedor. So even though he might not be the best legit fighter in the world, he's still probably pretty damn tough. And so I you know, I think you, for me at least, it doesn't necessarily make him the toughest guy in the world, but it does make him a pretty tough pro wrestling character, in my opinion.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this match quite a lot. I mean, they would have a number of matches over the years. And again, pinning the champion here in the finals, he wins the G1, and that would set things up for their rematch in October, where Tanahashi would win the title back from Nagata. So, I mean, 2007 was a pretty pivotal year in Hiroshi Tanahashi's ascent into the main event picture and staying there. And then we go to our final G1 that we're going to review. This one just from a few years ago in August of 2012, involving another star that was on the rise at this point. Very similar circumstances with Kazuchika Okada taking on Carl Anderson, Machine Gun Carl Anderson. Okada had his infamous run with TNA Wrestling in 2010, 2011, and then came back to New Japan. The idea was, here was this guy who kind of started off in Mexico, came back to New Japan, was retrained or went through their dojo as well, and then was sent off to TNA, where it was the classic send the guy to another territory, and he was going to come back as a pivotal person.
Yeah, and he'll be changed.
Yes. Forever. Okaito will just take the world over. This will go down in history as one of the great misuses of a talent as TNA and their utilization of one Okada. So Okada came back to New Japan, and it was much more a rehab project than it was building on anything TNA garnered for this guy.
Right. Well, how much attention does TNA get in Japan? How many people would have seen this?
I think it was pretty minimal in terms of actually TNA. More so, it would have been coverage of Okada just succeeding in the U.S. And
I'm sure you could very much reframe that about how he went to TNA, he conquered TNA, as Okada had a wonderful run.
His visa was denied. So the man with his courageous mask worked under a secret identity this whole time as the Green Hornet's assistant.
Yes. They had so much reverence for him, they put him under a Bruce Lee character.
So, I mean, 2012 was very interesting because Okada won the IWGP title in February of that year, and everyone was stunned because I don't think anyone thought Okada was ready for that title. It turns out he was pretty damn ready, and by the G1, I think everyone realized, because I mean, this guy was coming in with some baggage with this TNA run, and now all of a sudden we're going to take this glorified comedic character that TNA had and try to make him into a main eventer. Is that really going to work? And it ended up that this was one of their next stars and will probably go down as Tanahashi's top rival. And in the G1, Okada was certainly a big focal point, and Carl Anderson was as well, because in 2012, Giant Bernard, Matt Bloom, had left the company where he was teaming with Carl Anderson for a long time as Bad Intentions, and Carl Anderson was left on his own, and it was this guy very easily could have floundered, and instead they really got behind him, and he... This was a breakout year for Carl Anderson, and this was one of his most famous matches.
How would you grade him as a wrestler prior to this?
I mean, he was... I thought the tag team served its purpose with Giant Bernard, and that's largely what you saw with Carl Anderson. I didn't see a whole ton of him before this point in time. He was always, I thought, very good. I never saw him at a level much above that kind of middle of the card, and... Right. Him and Okada, they have had some tremendous matches over the years. This might be their best. It's definitely near the top, if not the best match that the two have had. They have very tremendous chemistry. And Carl Anderson, he's really carved out a spot for him in New Japan. I think he's very overlooked when it comes to the best talent in New Japan. So we had Okada defeating Togi Makabe and Carl Anderson pinning Hiroshi Tanahashi earlier in the show. Tanahashi was the IWGP champion, so Anderson pins the champion and then goes to the finals. And
it seems like a very like classic device that they use in these G1 tournaments.
Yeah, it's just the champion's in there for a reason. He's not just there to lose for no reason. It's to set up your fall programs, and they would do that with Anderson and Tanahashi. And it was kind of like Carl Anderson got a ton out of this tournament, even in losing in the finals. Yeah. And this was also the year they introduced the Money in the Bank deal, where the winner would get the briefcase and get a future title shot coming out of this tournament. So early in the match, it's in Sumo Hall as usual. Crowd was super hot at the beginning of this for both guys. The Rainmaker and Gunstun are both blocked early on, and the crowd reacts really well to the teases. They fought on the outside of the apron, and Anderson snaps the right arm of Okada on the top rope to affect the Rainmaker that the announcers bring up, and later on runs the shoulder into the barricade. Okada is selling for the next few minutes before he seats Anderson on the top turnbuckle and hits that beautiful drop kick, sending Anderson off the top to the floor, and then would work on the neck of Anderson for the next few minutes. He wrapped it into the barricade. He hit a draping DDT to the floor, teasing the countout that Anderson got in at 19. Okada's got the heat. Anderson comes back and hits a senton. Okada then goes back to the neck. There's a top rope elbow drop, and Okada calls for the Rainmaker. Anderson blocks it on the first try, and then Okada applies the deep in debt submission. Anderson gets the rope break, and then Anderson comes off the top with a reverse neck breaker. Sorry, blocks the reverse neck breaker of Okada, hitting a running power bomb. There's the heavy rain hit by Okada. Then Anderson blocks the tombstone, and we fast forward as Anderson hits the Bernard driver for this great near fall. That coming after a spinning gun stun from the second turnbuckle. The announcing here, I don't know what the fuck they were saying.
I was going to say the same thing.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was so insane.
It's simply the tone of, like, I often wonder if we understood the Japanese, and if we understood the commentary here, would it be better or would it be worse?
It might be worse.
It might be worse. I mean, sometimes because we understand the words so well, like we see it so clearly, we can point out all the flaws. Here we're able to just enjoy this man's beautiful... What's his name, the announcer, you know?
Shinpei Nogami.
Okay, we're able to enjoy his like beautiful delivery, beautiful intonation. It's so fucking good,
and it's matching the crowd, which is going nuts. Yeah. And you've just got like, especially when it's just some like just a long yell. It's like I don't need a translator. Yeah, this dude is losing his mind for this match.
I'd love to hear him like call golf, you know, like something, or curling, you know, something that's just so fucking boring. But if I'm sure if he was able to accentuate the excitement, it'd be interesting.
This was so tremendous, and the final sequence was just so great. Okada connected with a drop kick. He blocks two gun stuns. Anderson connects with the bicycle kick, then blocks another gun stun, and Okada drop kicks him, tombstones him, lifts him up, hits the Rainmaker, and pins Anderson at 23 minutes and 20 seconds, and Okada becomes the youngest person to win the G1 at the tender age of 24.
Wow. That's very
young. That's crazy. Guy's only 27.
Yeah.
Like, this guy's going to be a star for the next 15 years if he stays healthy.
That means he must have been, like, 19 when we first saw him in, like, UWA.
Oh, he would have been. Yeah, that would have been 2006.
Yeah, it's so St. John's Hall. I thought Anderson here was very impressive. I mean, Okada, I think I've already heard so much about, but I hadn't really seen much of Carl Anderson. But in this match, I was very impressed by him. In particular, I mean, I don't know.
I think up until this point, this was the best match of Carl Anderson's career.
Like, I really do wonder if in the past several, like, past couple decades, is there a better finisher than the Ace Crusher? You know, like the way we've seen people from Austin to DDP to Orton to, you know, Carl Anderson here just employ it in such a variety of ways out of nowhere. It's really great.
Someone needs to put together a compilation of the different gun stun finishes from this year's G1, because it's been like Anderson's challenge throughout this G1 to come up with the most. Not ridiculous, but just out of nowhere finishes to this. Mm. It's almost like he's watched Randy Orton's matches, and it's like, how can I top this? And right. Some of them, like whether it was Elgin going for a spinning powerbomb and he turns it into one, the best one to me was Tomoaki Honma climbing to the top, and he just does the dead dive off the top, and yeah. Anderson pops up in midair and catches the dive,
wow.
Diving headbutt into the gun stun, and they've been awesome.
Has he tried the springboard into the backwards fall into a gun stun yet?
He has not tried that yet.
No?
That'll be
oh, God. Like, what the fuck? Why?
Terrible.
Why does Cena still do that?
The best, I still feel the best one I've ever seen is Orton Stavenborn.
Yeah.
The shooting star.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, extra points that it was on Raw and was live. They had no cushion, and it was timed fucking perfectly.
See, but the Rollins one this year was pretty fucking
Rollins crazy. Was awesome at WrestleMania.
The fact
too.
That it was at WrestleMania, too.
I really want to see a Randy Orton-Carl Anderson match one
just,
day.
Just all.
Just for the finish sequences.
All Ace Crushers.
That should be the whole match.
Yeah.
Is both trying to hit it,
yeah.
And then they finally hit it and get the win.
Yeah. And DDP runs in.
Yeah,
and,
you know,
and
DDP,
Johnny Ace could run in as well.
DDP had some decent ones, but man, Anderson and Orton's transitions are so much better.
It's a different time, you know. Orton, you know, probably way more athletic than DDP.
100%. Yoga be damned, but yeah, I mean, that was also DDP in the mid-90s. So that concludes. To be honest, this 2012 final was off the charts, in my opinion. I've always enjoyed Okada and Anderson's matches together, and this was really fun to go back and watch. And then really it was 2013 and 14, which were the years that became much more accessible when the tournaments got onto Ustream and now on New Japan World. So 2012 was the last one where a lot of it was just like I was just reading along. I didn't get to see a whole lot of the tournament matches over the years. So it was cool that New Japan World put up all these finals, and you can go back and watch them. There are some others I watched as well that were really fun to go back and watch.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, this was a tournament designed to put over new talent.
That's always so. Been, yeah, the key to the G1 is, you know,
and
top matches for throughout some of the biggest matches of the year, and also trying to create that next star, which some years have been successful, others have not. And
what would you say the purpose is this year for the G1? Is there a purpose like that?
Well, this year, I mean, largely it's been, you know, you have Okada in there, so he's going to be a player right down to the last couple of days, and creating some challenges for him. But also at the other end, I think this year it's twofold. It's AJ Styles has just lost the title, so he's certainly being kind of rehabbed in this tournament, just winning with all different variations. Tetsuya Naito's new heel character has been a huge success, I feel. He was a guy that was... He was almost like a Sheamus character, maybe. Someone who was, you know, he was...
Really sucked.
It's not really... Naito's, I think, a much better performer than Sheamus. But he was just... He was there. He was a babyface that most people didn't really enjoy. And he was just there. And this heel character has given him a whole new life in New Japan. And he's been great in this tournament. Kota Ibushi is like... The young guy that they're bringing up that you see as maybe one day getting to that level. But it's like, we watch this. It's like, Tanahashi was winning this tournament at 30. He was already in the finals at 27. 27, they knew he was a guy. Ibushi's already 33. Mm-hmm. He's not as young as people think. He's got a very young-looking face, mm-hmm. and he's new to the main event mix. But he's not a spring chicken. He's 33 years old. But he's had some tremendous matches throughout the tournament. So I would say those are some of the stories. I don't think we're getting kind of this breakout star this year. It's more setting up matches for the fall, as well as, you know, at the end of the day, the winner is going to be headlining Wrestle Kingdom, and that's kind of shifted the focus now from taking a star out of the mid-card and creating a new main eventer.
When did they start that?
The 2012 year.
Oh, okay.
And Okada would go on.
That's the briefcase.
Yeah, he got the briefcase and would challenge Tanahashi at the Wrestle Kingdom show.
Cool. Timing-wise, it really works out.
Yeah, that G1 show was notable because that same finals was when they reintroduced Sakuraba and Shibata coming back to New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Interesting. So,
that was our look at five finals from the G1 Climax. Fun to go back and watch these.
It was fun and educational for me, having, you know, not really seen that much of New Japan, especially through the 90s, so it was great.
Yes, and you can also, you know, now that we have the vast archives at lawradio.proboards.com, you can go back. Episode 2 of Japanese Audio Wrestling was the week after the G1 in 2012, so you can get Chris and WH's thoughts.
They've been doing this show for that long?
Yeah, 3 years.
Oh, my God. That means we've been doing the show for even longer than that.
No, six?
That's crazy.
So we are now going to head over to said message board. We did get some feedback to the show. I know not everybody has New Japan World out there, so we do appreciate the feedback you did send in. Why don't you start things off, Wei?
All right, we go to Chris in Ottawa, who says, "Gentlemen, always a pleasure. I found it fascinating to chart the history of the G1 with these matches, as I'm a relatively recent convert to the promotion, and I'm only very familiar with its renaissance and the era of Tanahashi, Nakamura, and Okada as its three aces. To be perfectly frank, looking back only reinforces how pleased I am that the promotion has evolved to where it is today, in terms of presentation and in-ring styles. In recent years, you could say post-Nakamura transformation, or the arrival and ascendance of Okada, I believe that New Japan has really tapped into a product that has both broad appeal and satiates the appetite of many wrestling fans outside of Japan that feel left out by what the WWE and other promotions market to the Western audience. Any wrestling fan should find the big New Japan shows to be tremendously entertaining, language barrier notwithstanding. A 10 out of 10 to the top promotion in the world and its phenomenal tournament."
Wow. So there you go. Chris giving it the big thumbs up. You wonder if like, there's, like, circles in Japan where it's, like, they're so used to the New Japan product being the promotion of note, mm-hmm. that there's, like, when WWE was, like, there's, like, an underground of people who are like, yeah, but the real wrestling's in WWE.
I'm sure there is.
And it's so funny.
Yeah, the WWE.
Like, I'm sure that there's, you know, Chris and WH can speak to it better, but I'm sure there's a certain audience that feels like New Japan is the big mainstream. And they're not super mainstream.
They're able to point out all the problems with the booking.
I mean...
There's a Japanese version of us.
Listen, there's stuff about New Japan booking at times that is, you know, there's sometimes they go to the well way too many times with parody. Sometimes you need to distance yourselves from that because then people are not as special when you just book everyone the same. You have to adjust to the appetite of your audience and what people respond to. It's not like New Japan is this flawless promotion.
There could be some, like, Japanese people who think Michael Cole is just amazing.
What do you think he's saying? If we knew what he was saying, would it be better or worse?
Yeah, very much. I'm definitely sure.
You have, like, crowds. Vintage. That's all that they can decipher. Mm-hmm. Chris in Mississauga, "It was about a year ago that I started listening to the Review Away podcast and the Law in general. One of the first things I remember John talking about last year was the G1 tournament, and my interest peaked. I was always aware of New Japan, but had never seen a show or match. I tracked down a match between Okada and Tanahashi and was instantly hooked. From there, I backtracked all of the shows from Wrestle Kingdom 7 onwards, and I've been following this year's G1 on New Japan World. It was interesting to check out a younger Tanahashi in 2004 and earlier Chono matches. I wasn't aware Tenzan and Kojima were as high as they were back in the day, but I hope guys like Nakamura don't suffer the same fate as opening match curtain jerkers when their careers wind down. With New Japan being covered on Access TV, With the best commentary in the business, I hope the promotion continues to gain exposure. Having Liger at the TakeOver show has me hoping that New Japan can foster a partnership with the WWE like they used to have with WCW. I strongly disagree with the assertion by Vince Russo that Japanese stars would not be able to get over in North America. Who wouldn't love Nakamura, Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania next year? Anyway, I've just about caught up with 6 years worth of Review Away podcasts. It was great meeting you guys at the ROH show, one of the Wei Ting Drinks Green Tea sign guys. Thank you for the entertainment. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I remember you guys.
Yeah, one thing that I think has really been, I hope can evolve now that Access, they have a bigger stake now and a longer relationship with New Japan, is that there can be more crossover. Because if you watch just the Access show, mm-hmm. you're not kept abreast of anything that's happening currently. You're not made aware of New Japan World.
They're almost done in semi-highlight form.
Yeah.
A lot of the shows.
Well, some of them it's by necessity that, I mean, if you're doing, like, they're covering the G1 currently, and they'll do one big match in its entirety, and then they've got to fill out the rest in clip form because they just don't have the time to do it. But it's tough in Canada because it's really hard to find those Access shows if you're in Canada. We don't get Access, literally and figuratively, and...
But everybody has the internet. I don't think it's
Dude,
that
even
hard.
On the internet, I have a hard time tracking down those shows. So maybe I got to go to Pacific Mall and just, like, back order the entire catalog.
And DVDs.
So I very much want to hear the shows Frank Shamrock did. I want to hear him do.
When did those air?
Those aired over the last couple of weeks when Josh Barnett was away. Okay, last one is from Way.
We go to Ryan from Calgary, who says, I share similar sentiments to the gentleman above. I used to listen on my Pentium with Netscape app navigator.
Pentium. Remember Pentium processor? Yeah.
Yes, Intel Inside. With Netscape Navigator, when Jeff Merrick and the notorious TID were on, I dropped wrestling from my viewing when the Benoit deal went down so dirty, and for a while I only followed wrestling culture for the excitement and tragedy it inevitably produces. I too started listening to the podcast regularly, and I'm grateful for the hard work you guys put in. My questions. I tried signing up for New Japan World, and I had a lot of trouble navigating the Japanese. I use Chrome, and I hit the translate button, but I still found it difficult. I know it's kind of lame, but can you guys talk a little about using their interface, pros and cons against other streaming services? I use Netflix, Fight Pass, paid subscriptions on YouTube, etc. Also, for this year's G1, do you have any predictions for winners? I could say this was my first time on New Japan World, and... We even had some difficulty trying to get me to watch these shows because John, you know,
I've logged into New Japan World once, and I can't log in ever again.
John has forgotten his password.
I have no clue.
So these G1 podcasts that you guys are all enjoying,
could end any day.
Should anything happen to your laptop, we're all fucked. The world is fucked because John doesn't remember his password. He cannot log out. This is a semi-crisis that we are watching very closely. So thanks to somebody else at the office, I was able to get access. But you can't – well, if you don't know Japanese, you can't really navigate it.
I found the Google Translate. It was not too difficult.
It translates their names pretty perfectly.
Yeah.
Like if you actually type in, you know, Okada or whatever, all that stuff will come up. The other thing is the player is excellent. It's a very good player. It's not like the network. Like, the player, you know, sometimes like when you're on YouTube, you can actually use the shortcuts. Like, the back button will go back 30 seconds. It responds very, very well, at least for my usage.
What do you think of the new YouTube player?
I'm okay with it. It's fine.
I thought that was very risky, YouTube.
Definitely.
Changing their player.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you are the gold standard of streaming sites, and to change their player... I knew it seems to be fine.
All they did was just kind of make the bar transparent.
Yeah.
It's fine.
I think that the next phase of the WWE network, they've got to have a better player.
Definitely.
Like the idea that you can't even rewind or fast forward with like the time code on it drives me insane.
It's not very responsive. No.
And it's like 10 seconds back and forth. You can fast forward or rewind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's a bitch. If you're like, you want to go back 2 minutes, you're literally just trial and erroring it. To try and click on the right spot of a 3-hour show to go back 2 minutes. It drives me nuts. Mm.
What was your process like signing up for it at least?
I signed up pretty quickly when it first launched last December. My best bet would be to simply go online and maybe literally type in how to sign up for New Japan World. I'll give a shout out to Alan Forrell on Twitter. He would be the best person because he's written before, like a step by step process.
Alan Forrell, the number four.
The number four, not, the letter
not,
L.
Not Forrell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he will make you happy by signing up for New Japan World. That would be my best bet. I am not going to be able to take you through the steps if translating it to English has not figured
that,
it out for
What does
you.
That say, you know, about how much New Japan cares about its audience outside of Japan when we need to go to such lengths to try to get people to, like,
it's not easy, and it's not
gotta,
like...
I got to fucking work to give you money.
Yeah. I think that a lot of people probably overestimate how big of a service New Japan World is just in terms of the audience. I mean, this is not some gigantic thing to the WWE Network, from just following the business side of Fight Pass, New Japan World, like the WWE Network, the fact that here we are a year and a half later and they're at over 1.1 million subscribers, that's pretty fucking impressive. Mm-hmm. Granted, they've put more into their network content-wise and sacrificed more than anyone else has.
You can also argue that it's a bigger audience worldwide, you know, that pays
attention. Of course, of course. And there's good and bad to it. They do have what I will call a pretty respectable number of subscribers. At the same time, I think it's insane that they're putting WrestleMania next year on the network. Seems like that's a guarantee that they'll put it on the network. I think that's just... I know that people would be so pissed, but if there's one thing I've learned about wrestling fans, they are extremely loud, but do very little in terms of... I don't believe there would be a crazy amount of people unsubscribing to the network if they put WrestleMania on pay-per-view.
No.
And the business of that show could fuel the network for months. I mean, that would be such a big game changer for the WWE and their overall financial state for 2016 to put that show on pay-per-view and do a million buys at $60 a pop.
Well, WrestleMania for them, though, I think, in, you know, ever since the network began, it was their chance to acquire more members. Like, it was their season for their biggest push of the year. Could they still replicate that big push without putting Mania on as a draw?
No, they wouldn't. There would certainly be, like, that is the big, that's the big event of the year to jump your number up. There's no doubt that there's no way you can appease both sides. There's no way you can get a jump in numbers and put this on pay-per-view. You have to pick one or the other. My argument would be that the pinch of taking WrestleMania off the network for next year, I think, would more than pay for itself over the long run based on the revenue you would do on that one night.
Now that you already have, you know, your 1.1, your base, you know.
I don't think it would fall below that. I think if here we are at the end of June, it was at 1.1 and change. I think that's your basement at this point.
They also have, like, enough content, I think, right now to keep people on board. Like, namely, you know, the NXT specials, I think, are very good and swerved.
Great. Listen, if you tell me that next year, for WrestleMania time, we announce well in advance that WrestleMania is going to be on pay-per-view. And that weekend, you're getting the Hall of Fame. You're getting the NXT special on the Friday. Monday night, immediately after Raw, Steve Austin, an hour with Vince McMahon discussing WrestleMania. People on the fence, they're going to keep it.
Yeah.
They're going to keep it.
Yeah.
I think you have to over-deliver to the network. We're taking this away from you, but we're giving you way more. To not even encourage people to sign up just to maintain, I think you would be fine. I don't think it would be life and death as some people are pegging it to be if they were to do it. But it doesn't sound like they're going to do it. I just think it's a ton of money you're giving up to put next year's WrestleMania. Mm. So that will wrap things up. A very fun edition to go back and chat Japanese wrestling with one Wei Chung Ting. And next week, what are you smiling?
Nothing.
I'm not saying it's fun to talk about Japanese wrestling because you're Asian. I enjoy talking about any wrestling with you. Mexican, Japanese, catch.
Did not insinuate that.
You were giving me that look.
No, I did not.
Next week's show is brought to you by Lego and Nas.
Oh, yes.
The connection.
Lego, Nas, all things that Finn Balor enjoys.
Finn Balor pretty much put together a series of vignettes to request us to review a show this year. I know it was designed for you and I, Finn Balor. I know he listens to this every week. So next week, we're going to review his favorite pay-per-view event ever. Ever!
Of all time.
When the worlds collide, Starcades, WrestleManias, Triple Mania 23. No. Best of all time, SummerSlam 95.
Is it 95?
95.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought it was 94. Yes, 95.
Finn Balor's favorite pay-per-view of all time is headlined by Mabel.
Was it his favorite, or was it just the only tape he had around?
I think a lot of column A became column B.
Okay, got it.
So probably a lot of rewatch value for one Finn Balor.
Yes, he would watch the show as he would build Lego and presumably listen to Illmatic at the same time.
This should be a video review of you watching this while you listen to Nas and play with your Lego.
That's actually what I do every week anyway.
Wow. Well, next week we're going to review SummerSlam 95. This was in the doldrums of the WWF, but this was a hell of a show. As we go back, this is the forgotten ladder match with Shawn Michaels and Scott Hall.
Oh, cool.
After WrestleMania 10. Not the ladder match everyone really brings up a whole lot. It's always WrestleMania 10 that gets the focus. And then we're going to also talk about Diesel and Mabel, which thankfully is not 40 minutes.
Was that the main event?
That was the main event because Mabel won their G1, the King of the Ring, to get the title match against their Yuji Nagata.
Yes.
The only time Yuji Nagata and Tanahashi will be compared to Nash and Nelson Frazier. So that's coming up next week on the show. We'll also see Bret Hart against the Dentist Kane. And lots more to chat about.
Classics. I'm actually.
Are you already regretting this?
No. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Okay, so that will be the subject of next week's review. And taking us out is some New Japan commentary to properly put the exclamation point on this week's review away. And we'll speak with you next week.
岡田の後ろを取ってレインメーカー勝った。レインメーカー、岡田が勝った。苦しんで掴んだ史上最年少優勝。